This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Masserol. Are you ready to discover your True North Story?
For us, True North is finding that your purpose in life and your story is your circuitous route to getting there. And what I was so drawn to with you, John, is that you've had a few different purposes. You've reinvented yourself, finding maybe a new True North.
One of the things that focused for me was realizing, particularly in the wake of the recent recession, that a lot of people were hitting the middle of their careers and finding the road blocked to them in a variety of ways, and particularly for people in the boomer generation. And I'm a boomer. I was born in 1952, which seems kind of like amazingly ancient time ago. But the boomers are facing a particularly uncomfortable situation where the generation has undersaved for retirement, is the first echelon to be downsized as corporations are looking to tighten their belts and become more agile and nimble in a rapidly changing world. At the same time, we're much more vital and healthy and interested in continuing to work than previous generations. We still have kids at home or in college, and we have parents who are still alive and presenting their own challenges. So many of us, by some estimates, 10 million of us, are sandwiched between generations. With all of these career challenge, financial challenge, things looming ahead of us, we got to figure out how to prolong our careers beyond what we were taught, erroneously, was going to be retirement at age 65. So that's the dilemma. What I realized is that coming out of the entertainment business, which is a classically unstable and continually changing business. I mean, you're trying to anticipate the changing taste of the general public as a profession, which is kind of insane. I've gotten used to having to change jobs and change my outlook and repitch myself and reinvent myself along the way. So I realized that I have something to say and something to offer here about tips and tricks and techniques of reconceiving yourself and revising that narrative and bringing that out into the marketplace to create a new opportunity. And that this was something that maybe other people might be interested in learning how to do.
You know, that's really interesting. Tam and I were just talking before we got on the phone with you about technology and how that's changing the landscape for professional employment, but also to your point about the entertainment, the proprietary content that's being created. Technology is changing the value related to that, where you make a movie and you have the rights and you sell those rights, or you broadcast DVD markets and all these ancillary rights that go with it. And maybe now the internet is changing all that. And amidst all that, we have a labor participation rate that is low 60s, the lowest in 40 years. Speak to that a little bit. We've got this huge millennial generation. We've got a huge baby boomer generation. Gen X is sandwiched in the middle. These headwinds that you just referenced. So give us a little bit about where you think things are going, or where you think that there are ways where you can help baby boomers and Gen X and anyone in maybe navigating these waters that are a little bit frothy right now.
I think that the message is the world is changing very fast, that we have to all adopt the mindsets that grow out of the digital revolution. Challenge for boomers is to really understand what those paradigm shifts are.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that we're in a one of many shifts, but we're in a lean-in world versus a lean-back world, for one, where we're used to thinking of receiving communication, not just entertainment. It's not just about kind of laying back on the couch versus, you know, leaning in with a game controller. It's really about understanding that we have to engage with the information that we're being provided, not just passively receive it. It's an opportunity to participate in the dialogue and the conversation, as opposed to listening to the broadcast. And I think that applies across all areas of engagement. That's the boomer challenge. I think the millennial challenge may be understanding how to be more strategic about using the tools and to understand the applicability of the tools, business strategy in personal branding and personal development, communication, and understanding that layer. And I think that the ultimate opportunity for all of us here is to, and really it's more than an opportunity, I think it's an imperative, is that we all have to cooperate. And we all have to take what we know how to do and share that in the broader community so that we can all come up collaboratively with solutions for how to deal with the changing future.
I love that. One of the beautiful things that Tam and I are discovering with this True North Story podcast is that as we talk to people and we talk to guests and they share their stories with us and their influences and their inspiration and their dreams and kind of what's helped guide and shape that journey through a lifetime, you know, through their life arc, is that there are things that are common amongst the stories, and the collective keeps bubbling to the top, a greater vision and a greater sense of importance on the collective and collaboration. And the other that you just touched on is the engagement piece. We've talked to Bruce Pavitt, who is the founder of Sub Pop Records, and he is now doing a collaborative effort with Adam Farish called 8STEM that they feel is going to revolutionize music through engagement. And it's the exact right thing you said, where people are going to be able to interact and participate with music in a way that they'd never been able to do that before. And Cam and I were just absolutely blown away because you just nailed two of the themes that are kind of coming to the top that we're seeing people talk about. Does that affect maybe the pay? We kind of grew up going, well, if I am in this job with this title, I should, you know, in this many years experience and this background, I should make this much. But when you start talking about maybe leaning in and you start talking about a collective and a passion and a why behind what you're doing, does that change that? Does the money become less important, do you think?
Well, I think money's always important. I mean, we all, you know, we all need money to survive. I think that what has happened is that there's been a shift from value placed on time to value placed on results. And we are post-industrial. Our whole world has been, for the last couple hundred years, based on this idea of industrial production, one way or another, from not just from the factory, but the office was set up to reflect the factory, and schools, education has been set up to reflect the factory. And we're not in that value proposition anymore. You know, ever since we hit the information age, that industrial model was bound to crumble. A lot of us, I think, are still focused on or fixated on the idea that, well, what do I get paid per hour? And so much of HR in our society, even though many companies have moved past this, we're still stuck in this how much are you getting paid per hour mentality, and what should I be paid per hour, as opposed to really understanding what value are you providing to the bottom line. And that value may be more than monetary, that the cultural value or the value that you're providing is about building community. And in building community, you're creating a much more innovative environment where ideas are coming to the surface and being developed and productized and monetized to a much greater degree than they would have if you weren't part of the company. So the challenge now is, how do we quantify some of these traditionally soft skills and really understand how they fit into the value chain that we're all engaged in trying to figure out?
If I could just shift direction just a bit, John, you had quite an extensive career in the entertainment industry. I read that you were finding yourself on the beach, so to speak, about nearly 40% of the time during that career. Talk a little bit about how you found the entertainment industry. Were you always wanting to be creative and be in that process?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you're cute. You say I find myself on the beach. I was fired 39% of the time in my career, or I have been fired 39% of the time in my career. And I kind of dine out on that because I think it's important for people to understand, you know, back to the conversation we're just having about value and salary and jobs, that getting fired is not fatal, and that in a rapidly changing marketplace, moving jobs is not shameful. That if you're not the right fit at a given time on a given team, then you're not doing anyone any good, least of all yourself, by staying on that team. And there's another line that I'm just going to squeeze in here because I love to use this line that a teacher of mine once told me, and that is, God fires you from jobs you're too dumb to quit.
That's great.
And, And I think, I think that kind of describes it. It's like if you're just kind of holding on because you're clocking in every morning, doing the same old thing that you've been doing for the last 10 years, are you really providing value that's timely and necessary? I don't know, maybe. And I think the reinvention process doesn't necessarily have to be that you go away from that company and start a whole new career in a whole new field. You can reinvent yourself in that job. And I think most people, before they say, I'm fed up, I'm quitting, I can't do anything else here, and blah, 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 they don't appreciate me, is to look inside and figure, well, what do they need? What's the real need that I could be hopefully, potentially, possibly fulfilling? That's kind of, I think, the key challenge for us, is to understand that it's okay to change jobs and that changing careers is not shameful. You know, we can have a lot of impact, generate a lot of value for the people that we're working for and working with.
How many different hats have you worn in your years?
In doing the math, it all kind of came together for me. I was invited to do a TEDx talk about this a few years ago. And I thought, okay, well, let me just kind of figure out, if I'm here to talk about transformation and change, what qualifies me to do that? So I did the inventory. And over the 35 years or so of my career, I've had 18 different jobs. So that's kind of about 2 years per job. Some of them were shorter, of course. And then, of those jobs, and I don't have the count right in front of me, but 11 of them were jobs that I either ended or I quit to go to another job, but 7 of them I was fired. So that's where I come up with the 39% figure. And I kind of dine out on it because, again, it's about helping people to feel comfortable about where they are, to understand that you're more than your resume. You're more than your job. You're a work in progress. You're a resource that's evolving and growing. And in a strange way, getting fired from a job it can be a way to build character, because it forces you to look at what was going wrong there. What did I not do to either step up to the job itself? When did I lose interest? Or if I was working for a bad boss, why didn't I do something about it? Why didn't I leave? Why didn't I find another way out of it? So those setbacks can be tremendously valuable learning experiences. And I think if you come at it from a perspective of, what am I here to learn from this? Then you go into your next job interview and they say, so what happened at that last job? Traditionally, we cower at that question. It's the question that we hope they're not going to ask, but we know that they will ask.
Right.
We have to be prepared. We have to be prepared to say, well, it didn't work out. And I think I made some mistakes, or whatever you say to indicate that you're not trying to stonewall them about what happened. But the upside is that you've learned some lessons. And here are the lessons that I've learned, from that experience. And I feel like I'm a better person today, better worker, more strategic, more valuable, whatever, because of the fact that that job didn't work out. And I had to do some deep diving inside myself to figure out, how am I going to take advantage of that, turn that around, and use that to someone else's advantage next time out?
Well, John, it's really interesting, because as I get older, the one thing I do know is how much I don't know. And
exactly.
Somewhere along the line, we get into this thing that we're not supposed to admit failure. We're not supposed to show weakness, that we're not continually learning, continually evolving, and that our profession is supposed to be the static thing that we know all things. We come in, yes, we can do the job. Yes, I can do that. Yes, I've done that. I have 20 years experience. And it's really not like that. Do you think that maybe the industry is changing to embrace more of that? Or is that just wishful thinking on my part to say, hey, past experiences that maybe you weren't as good at, and that's okay, because you maybe will be better at these things, and that's what we're looking to hire somebody for? I mean, is it a little bit less stigmatizing to say that wasn't for me, or that didn't work out the way I thought it would?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And I think it's partly because the reality of jobs today, and again, it comes back to this idea of fit. I think if there's anything, I think there are a lot of things that generations can teach each other. And I think one thing that older workers can learn from younger workers who have grown up observing the decline of corporate loyalty and the compact that used to exist in our economy between the worker and the company. And so as a result, millennials are a lot more cynical, I think, about careers and about longevity in a career, and they're not expecting that. And I think that they have a different balance, what they're looking for, what they're expecting, and how they feel about themselves. I mean, I have a daughter who's 23, and I see how she is at work and people who hang out around her, and there is a more of an edge I think they have about who they are, where they fit, what they want to do. They get maligned for being entitled. I think that's a very unfair characterization. In my day job, I co-run a graduate program for Carnegie Mellon University that's based in Los Angeles that focuses on entertainment industry management. So these are students who want to go on to the business side of the industry as producers or executives or marketers, distributors, agents, managers, et cetera, across film, TV, music, and games. These are really dedicated young people who have got a very, very clear idea of what they want to do. They work really, really hard. They are spending a lot of time learning the ropes and have a tremendously professional attitude. Whenever I hear a boomer kind of go off on millennials, I have to stop them because it's not really what I see at all about this generation. I think they have a much, much clearer idea how we should all work to live as opposed to living to work. I think they have a much better aspiration there about work-life balance than we did.
That's so interesting. For us, I think it was looking for the blue chip company or the one studio and the gold watch, the retirement party after 35 years of good work and labor. I'm sure, John, that you, as a young person, when you got that first great studio job, were thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to be here for the next 20 years or 30 years and put in my time and be the best worker I can. And that's just not the way it is anymore.
It really hasn't been that way in a while. And again, you know, the younger generations know this. They experience it every day. And I think that the stats vary, but certainly the average kid coming out of college today, assuming they can get a job, is going to have a dozen jobs by the time they're 40 or 45. I mean, it's a completely different way of looking at life. I like to look at it, and I make this comparison with people about looking at the life stages that the older generations grew up with and that versus what's happening today. And talk to boomers about this. I say, you know, we grew up looking at three acts, and the three acts were education, career, and retirement. And the deal was, if you got a good education, that entitled you to a good career. You know, you got your diploma, you got your degree, you got into that job, and you could coast in that job 40 years. And then if you kept your nose clean, you were entitled to retire. And there you go. And you kind of sailed off into the sunset. And as we know, that just has no longer, you know, that hasn't worked out.
Right.
It's not the way it works anymore. But I do think that there are still three acts, but the three acts are different. And that if you assume that, as you guys were talking about, education is lifelong, you never stop learning. You have to continue to learn new things and grow and build your skills and really understand new stuff as it's coming down the pike. So the first stage then, instead of education, really is self-awareness. It's really knowing who you are, what you want to do, what you're good at, how you can be useful. And then the second stage is not really necessarily career in the sense that it used to be, but it's really about generativity, which is an expression that the psychologist Eric Erickson used about really understanding how you can generate value, be part of a community, express your value. And then the final stage is giving back. Once you've gotten to the point where you have all this experience, both life and professional experience, then you don't want to go away and disengage, you know, retire from the world. You want to stay engaged and give back and help the generations coming up behind you do a better job. You want to help them fulfill what their ambitions are. So I think a much better, if you look at it that way, it's much more holistic. It's more about openness and communication and support between generations. And that's kind of my Pollyanna way of looking at the future.
That puts work-life balance in a whole new perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series. And now, back to the program.
24-hour television, it's so loud that no one listens. Sex and money and politicians talk, talk, talk. But there really ain't no conversation. Ain't nothing left of the imagination. Trapped in our phones and we can't make it stop, stop. This noise, yeah, we scream, yeah, we shout, yeah, we don't have a voice. In the streets, in the crowds, it ain't nothing but noise.
So you, having come out of the entertainment industry, how do you see these kids going forward in entertainment? Do you see it as a long-term career choice that they can continue in? Will they have to reinvent themselves too?
Well, yeah, I think they'll have to reinvent themselves, but everyone's going to have to reinvent themselves. I mean, the funny thing about entertainment and me particularly coming into this is that, you know, entertainment's always been this way. And everybody I know pretty much in the entertainment business sees what I'm doing and they kind of all nod and go, yeah, well, of course. You know, we've all had to reinvent ourselves continuously, but the rest of the world didn't used to work this way. But now, because of technology and the way the economy has been developing. Everything is like this now. You know, the rest of the world has become the way entertainment has always been, where you just can't predict what's going to go on 18 months from now. And, you know, when I had my tech startup in the 90s, still wrote five-year income statements, you know,
sure,
projections for,
yeah,
for where the company was going to be in 5 years. And today, if you're writing a three-year projection, I think your people think, well, you're kind of pushing the fringes. Go to the South by Southwest conference every year, which I love. I'm always very interested in what's going on the interactive side. And I remember a couple years ago listening to a young startup CEO from a prominent, at that time prominent, startup talk about the future. And the journalist who was interviewing him asked him, he said, well, what do you, you know, where do you see the company in 3 to 5 years? And this guy kind of sat back. He said, no, we don't think that far ahead. We feel that we're lucky if we're going to still be here in 30 months.
From a CEO?
Yeah.
So they just are putting in the time and the giving the value while they can.
Well, I don't think that they expect to be out of business in 30 months. I think what they're saying is that they have to be focusing on what's happening today, and they have to be strategic more in real time. They can't just say, well, here's where we're going to be in 5 years, and here's the plan that's going to take us there, and rely on the market remain stable enough for them to get there. They're saying, we believe that we have a plan, and we're also willing to iterate on that plan and be flexible enough to meet the market where it's actually going, as opposed to where we think it's going to go or where we'd like it to go.
Right. And, you know, it's really interesting, John, because we were just talking to someone who's a big social media person. He was talking, I think, in the next 10 years, correct me if I'm wrong, Tama, that 50 billion devices will be connected or interacting
right.
with the internet in
right.
the next 10 years. And I mean, when you start talking about the interactivity side of or interaction side of South by Southwest and all of that, I guess my question is, that impacts everything, the interactivity part and the connection part, to a point that if you're not living in that moment, it's already changed. It's a different moment. And that goes for entertainment, but it goes for music. It goes for everything. And if you're a company or a brand, I mean, look at Apple. You know, they were revolutionary with their products initially, the iPhone, the iPod, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. tablets. I mean, all this crazy. And now, Tam and I were just talking that they're having to discount their watches because mm-hmm. they can't sell them. Is that a victim? Is Apple a victim of not moving quick, not being in the moment and having that stuff change around them? Where 30 months to the CEO, that could be catastrophic to them if they're not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, no one is immune, right?
Right.
And around 1999, you know, the government was suing Microsoft for bundling the browser in with the operating system. And, you know, Microsoft was the big bad wolf engaging in monopoly practices. And then, you know, today, Microsoft is still big, taking some hits, right? And it was
right.
late to the device party, and Windows phones are pretty much gone.
Right.
You know, they've been kind of on the fringe, and Google's been kicking butt, and Apple's been
exactly.
kicking butt, and who knows what's going to happen in 5 years. Twitter was 10 years old. That's a company that's been in flux over the last year. People are still kind of wondering, where is that going to go? We just don't know. There's a book called The Black Swan
mm-hmm.
by
yeah.
a guy named Nassim Taleb, who is, a risk manager and consulting company numbers guy. And the Black Swan refers to, I mean, no one used to think back hundreds of years ago that swans came in anything but white. And the idea of a black swan was it was kind of like an expression, like, you know, a cold day in hell or something like that.
Right.
And then they found a black swan. This idea of the black swan is the revolutionary event that changed the world, had tremendous import, was completely unexpected. But in retrospect, the cell phone. I mean, in 1985, would you have ever thought that you would need a cell phone? Landlines are fine. And I've got a landline at the office and a landline at home. But
right.
You know, no one needed a cell phone, and you couldn't give them away. You know, they were bulky, and they were like the size of a small suitcase. And, you know, there are all sorts of things that are black swans that we're dealing with all the time. Donald Trump is a black swan, right?
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, I just say that he is a phenomenon of tremendous impact that was completely unpredictable. And
right.
We have had to continually update our understanding of why he has been so impactful. And that is the essence of the black swan and the idea that you look back on it and you understand completely why it worked, but you don't see it coming. Particularly in a changing world, something we have to be mindful of. You were saying before about as you get older, you realize that you don't know what you don't know, or you realize how much you don't know. And
right.
I think that's the key. The key is we have to be nimble about change. We have to get our antenna very, very finely tuned to the changes that are going on around us and learn to pivot and respond to the changes as they're happening, as opposed to kind of waiting, and then having to react in a way that's not to our advantage down the line when we absolutely can no longer sit idle. We have to do something, but it's not.
And the cost is so much greater by waiting,
exactly.
Right? I mean, you know, the consequence, whatever it may be, if it's losing your job or it's the company going bankrupt or, you know, a myriad of things. But you bring up an interesting thing, and I wanted to just touch on this a little bit because I come from a little bit of a consulting background. I worked for Ernst & Young for a little while, and, you know, that's a very, very formulaic culture, been around for a very long time, you know, the partner track and all of that. And you are groomed to not really admit mistakes and not take ownership of things because it can be so costly. And so to your point about being able to pivot and being nimble and saying, hey, you know what? I may not know this. I may not have this knowledge base, but I can collaborate with someone who does. And together we can bring 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 or 20 other people together and do really amazing things.
Yep.
Do you see that as a part of the future professional work environment where it's going to be much more acceptable to pull people in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it already is. I mean, I think that, and that is really one of the great virtues of technology is that it allows us to connect much more quickly and much more meaningfully with people in a professional context and gives us great tools to collaborate and to do so remotely and effectively. And
that's great.
I think it's phenomenal. I mean, again, it's about being more entrepreneurial. It's having all sorts. I mean, all of your business is kind of a side business.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
There's kind of like a set of layers, professional layers that we're all going to be working in. We may have, you know, one job, which is a W-2 straight kind of employment job, and maybe we get benefits from that job, and there's a certain number of hours that we work at that job, or maybe there's certain deliverables that we are committed to for that job. And then there's other stuff that we do, and there's entrepreneurial stuff, and then there are people that we hang out with, and maybe we all do a project together at one time, or maybe we launch something together, or maybe we all go together to some other person's platform and create something for that platform. And maybe that takes off and becomes its own business. I mean, who knows?
It's really amazing. And I mean, filmmaking is obviously a collaborative art form or entertainment business. I shouldn't say art form because filmmaking is a business, but it's it's very collaborative, right? I mean, it is an art. It's all of those things, I guess. How would you describe it?
It's an art form. It's also, it's a business. It's performance. It's a lot of things.
If you name one thing that you're most passionate about, John, what one or two things bubbles up to the surface?
Oh, wow. Well, I guess people's potential. That's kind of over the last 10, 15 years, I have realized that that's what turns me on the most is to understand what makes someone tick and to really track and support them in becoming, sounds like a cliche, but as good a person as they can be. I think that particularly at a time where we are so empowered by technology, I'm just really curious and jazzed about what we can do with that and how we can work together. Thrilled to meet with people and talk with people about what they're doing and what ideas they're coming up with and how they can affect those ideas. And for the people that I work with in a coaching context, removing obstacles to them being able to make these things happen.
Tell us a little bit about your book, John, and then we'll wrap up.
I realized as I was kind of getting into this that I needed to finally set down on paper, on a screen, if you're going to read it on a screen, the underlying principles of career reinvention that I've been both trying to figure out for myself and pulling together from lots of different sources over the years. So the book is called Boomer Reinvention, How to Create Your Dream Career After 50. And it's aimed at people who I still think are mid-career, people in their 50s, who have good 15, 20 years or maybe even more ahead of them, and who are kind of blindsided by what's been going on in the economy and in their lives, and looking to better set themselves up for this next 15, 20 years. And the five steps that I talk about in the book are the following. Reframe your sense of yourself, your sense of what you can do, your sense of how the world works around you. The first step in manifesting change is to be able to take a step back and look with a different perspective. So that's where the reframing comes in. The second step is to listen. You want to be able to go out, get feedback from your universe about who you are, what you've done, what your strengths and weaknesses are, and really get a sense of how the world perceives you. That's an important part of it. Third step is to accept everything, to accept primarily the challenges and the failures or perceived failures, things that have knocked you down over the course of your career. And I think if you've gotten into your 50s, you've got a little mileage on you. You've had some bumps along the road. You've burned some bridges. Maybe people have treated you badly. And if you don't accept these things and be willing to move on and forgive yourself and forgive the other people who may have done you wrong, you're going to be harboring this negativity in whatever you do in the future. There's always going to be a little bit of a chip on your shoulder somewhere about what happened to you in the past, and it may block perfectly good opportunity that you may encounter. So you got to clean up the past.
Interesting.
And then the next two steps really are what I call the express step, which is to express to yourself first and then to the people around you what you want to do, what turns you on at this point in your life. It's updating all these ideas about what you're good at, where you can be useful, what makes you want to get up in the morning, and do this really pretty much for the rest of your career, because I think now this is really the final act for us. And it may sound ominous, but I think it can be glorious, particularly if you have figured out that there are certain things that give you a tremendous amount of meaning and purpose. And back to your overall topic, I think this is a very, very important question for people later in life is, you want to be able to leave a legacy. You want to be able to feel as you're getting older that you've really followed your heart, done something that is going to make a positive impact in the world. So that's the express step. And you use mind mapping techniques and journaling and all sorts of personal development tools to kind of figure that out and start taking it out into the world in the final step, which is the connecting step, and do it in a way which is appropriate for a technological age. So it's no longer about sending your resume out to 25 different people or 25 different versions of your resume to 150 different people, because nobody reads resumes anymore, right? You've got to be on LinkedIn. You've got to be focusing on your network as opposed to on your resume. And I'm always telling people, whether they're boomers or my grad students, you want to be chasing relationships, not job opening, because that's how you're going to find the affinity group that you resonate with. And you want to be working with people that want to work with you and vice versa. You don't want to be the lonely cog in some strange wheel that is just paying the bills but not really giving you any juice. That, in a nutshell, is the five steps to reinvention, tailored for boomers.
It's all about the collaborative, right?
You bet.
John, thanks so much for being with us and for sharing your True North story.
It has been fun.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story and tune in next time for another True North Story.